All right, welcome to another T-Rex Talk. This one is not recorded in the car. Hopefully the audio should be much better. And we're talking about 3D printed firearms. And we're doing that for a couple of reasons. One of them is, in the news recently, there has been talk about more censorship in social media. And I realized that since our podcast is less censored or less controlled than the media that we put on other platforms, we should make the most of that. So this past week, YouTube said that they were going to demonetize all videos of climate change deniers and start kicking content and channels off of the platform if they were deemed to be anti-vax content or anti-vax channels. And there was a Facebook whistleblower. I think Veritas Press was getting so much attention for all of their whistleblowers that the other side decided that they should also have a whistleblower. But you notice there's a slight difference between the whistleblowers that are shunned and blackballed and the whistleblower that came out from Facebook and was immediately verified on Twitter with a blue check mark and got a glowing 60-minute segment and a very flattering Senate interview and is currently represented by the spokesperson of the White House's PR firm. That's right. The spokesperson for the White House, the Biden administration, has a PR firm. That PR firm is representing the Facebook whistleblower as we speak. And the other telling thing is that particular whistleblower really only had one complaint. The great complaint that she had about Facebook, the deep, dark secret that she revealed to all of these adoring fans was that there wasn't enough censorship on the Facebook platform. There wasn't enough Republican or conservative misinformation being censored. That's the other little clue that maybe this is an insider, an institutional whistleblower. So yeah, I anticipate that there is more censorship coming down the pike for the various social media platforms. And this podcast is something that that we can host ourselves. Potentially, we get kicked off of Spotify. Potentially, we get kicked off of the iTunes aggregator. Potentially, we are no longer visible on Google. But you will always be able to find the MP3 files if you have our RSS feed and you're on our website. So this morning, this is Saturday, I woke up and I said, we should make the most of the freedom that we have on the podcast and talk about stuff that we're not allowed to talk about elsewhere. Let's talk about 3D printed guns. And then a little later today, I got some news that made it even more appropriate for us to talk about 3D printed guns. If you don't know the 3D printed gun scene, you probably don't know about Jay Stark. He was a private firearm engineer in a country that doesn't allow private firearm engineers. He was very careful about hiding his identity. He was very careful about sourcing the materials that he was using to make his firearms. We received word this morning that he passed away in some conjunction with his house being raided. It isn't clear if he actually died in police custody or if he was found dead in his own vehicle after being captured by the police and his house raided, even though they found nothing. Jay Stark has been confirmed to have died. So let's talk a little bit about 3D printed firearms. This is something that is a little bit difficult to research because people are not particularly clear on their terms. The media talks very often about ghost guns. Politicians talk very often about ghost guns, unserialized guns, guns that can pass undetected through metal detectors that are impossible to find, that are impossible to trace. But let's be a little more precise. I have divided the categories of homemade 3D printed firearms into four different categories, partly because it helps explain things, but also because I seem to have crippling obsessive compulsive disorder when it comes to organizing things into categories. So the first category is going to be all 3D printed firearms, all plastic, no metal, or as little metal as possible. This would include things like the Liberator pistol that was released in 2012. The only metal in the gun was one nail that was used as the firing pin. There was a rubber band that actually worked as the spring. Everything else was plastic, including the barrel, which meant that it didn't last very long. None of these all-plastic firearms are particularly robust. They all suffer some sort of catastrophic failure after not very many rounds, but they cause a huge amount of panic because they are indetectable. And now the ammunition inside is not indetectable, and technically they're not actually that indetectable, but for all intents and purposes, the media has decided that these are ghost guns. They're impossible to detect. Anybody can be a John Malkovich president killer and just have one of these in his pocket and go anywhere that he wants. Now, there's a couple of different designs of these. There was a zigzag revolver that was a little more interesting, came out of Japan. The developer of that was punished for being that ingenious. But generally speaking, very few people are working on these plastic-only guns. They're only being made, they were only made in the early days of 3D printed guns, just kind of to make a point, to see if it was possible as an experiment. But the second category of homemade 3D printed firearms is different. It's basically do-it-yourself, no factory-made gun parts, but they're not trying to avoid metal. So a great example of this is actually pre-3D printing, the Philip Luty submachine gun. So it was a scratch-built, completely homemade gun. No factory-made gun parts at all. Nothing that was originally constructed to be part of a firearm, but it was made out of metal, and it was made with hand tools. And so Philip Luty built this submachine gun to prove a point that it was possible to break UK firearm laws simply by making a firearm using hand tools. And he even published a book in 1998, The Expedient Handmade Firearm Book, which got him 4 years in jail. And after he got out, a few years later, in 2009, some anti-terror units raided his house. They found plumbing supplies, and they found copies of the book that they knew that he had written and that was already on the market. And they launched a new criminal case against him. And he was actually in pretty late-stage cancer at that point. The court ruled that he could not have access to internet or interact with certain people. He died before he could be convicted. But I bring him up because he's a great example of this second category of do-it-yourself firearms, which is nothing in the gun itself was originally made to be in a firearm. It's all adapted stuff. And an excellent example of this is the FGC-9, which is the weapon that was designed largely by Jay Stark and released in 2020. The plans were released in 2020 after he had worked on it quite a bit. Everything inside of the gun is either an off-the-shelf industrial part, all the springs and all the fasteners are the sort of things that you can get at a hardware store, and then 3D printed parts holding all of it together, the upper receiver, the lower receiver, etc. Also, electrochemical machining for the rifled barrel. And because magazines are hard to come by, 3D printed Glock magazines to hold the ammunition. Now, this is the very best homemade gun platform that I'm aware of that is this second category of firearm. I want to bring up something that happened in 2019. This is something that's going to be brought up anytime, particularly in Europe, anytime anyone talks about homemade firearms, they're going to bring up the Halle synagogue shooting. And the reason that they bring this up is because it's one of the very few situations in which a 3D printed firearm is actually used in a murder. The shooter, strangely enough, had a Luty gun made out of steel, but then he also had a 3D printed Luty gun as well, which is just bizarre on a whole bunch of different levels. First of all, it is crazy to take a design, which is made to be fabricated out of sheet steel, and 3D print that. And then secondly, there are no files of this gun on the internet. In 2019, there are tons of 3D printable gun files on the internet. And the shooter is on the internet a lot. He's ostensibly activated or radicalized on the internet. He's on all the extreme right-wing meme pages that we hear about. He streamed his shooting actions on Twitch in English, which is interesting because he didn't actually speak English well. And he was theoretically talking to a German audience, but he was streaming on Twitch, speaking to people in English. He attacked a synagogue, but he couldn't actually get in. So he killed a woman who was on the sidewalk who told him to be quiet. And then he killed a man who was inside a kebab shop. And then he wounded two people while he was fleeing. And he left behind a manifesto, which was a very typical straw man, neo-Nazi type of thing. And he had the usual ties to the Adam Waffen Division, which we now know in 2021 is a group largely run, apparently, by FBI informants, and their publishing arm largely funded by FBI dollars. So I'm curious whether the FBI has apologized to the people of that town who were injured by this guy who theoretically had strong ties to this ubiquitous neo-Nazi organization that they have been infiltrating for the last 15 years and apparently funding and apparently organizing for the last 15 years. They probably haven't, because the FBI is actually pretty busy trying to catch domestic terrorists at PTA meetings, because the real threat is people, particularly parents, who have opinions about the way that their children should be raised. But sorry for that rabbit trail. Let's get back to the guns. Again, it's fascinating that this particular shooter had a 3D printed Luti gun, a gun that is designed to be made out of sheet steel, and there are no files of this that exist really anywhere. I'm not saying that it is suspicious exactly, but I am saying that I'm kind of surprised that that gun didn't also have a MAGA hat on it, a little red MAGA hat on the front maybe, and then also maybe some Bible verses painted on the side. Like, that's the real mystery. But let's get back to Jay Stark. So Jay Stark, at the same time, and also in Germany, he is developing his own design, the FGC-9. And most of the weapons in this category that are being developed using only off-the-shelf parts are being developed in Europe, where it is very, very, very difficult to get any firearm components whatsoever. Barrels, even springs, magazines, and ammunition. So in the European do-it-yourself firearm scene, you also see people experimenting with some fascinating stuff, casting their own bullets, plating their own bullets, putting together their own ammunition using things that here in the United States we don't really think about, because even with the rising ammunition costs, it's actually very, very easy to find bullets, cartridges, and even primers. But the media over there, even with all of these controls, are still spending a lot of time talking about the dangers of 3D printed firearms. They're very much focusing on trying to confiscate these things. Earlier in June of this year, the Finnish police managed to find a small factory, they called it. They were six 3D printers, and inside of the apartment with the six 3D printers, people were actually making FGC-9s. So a factory making illegal firearms that were going to be misused. Europe is actually pretty full of black market guns. There's a lot of black market guns available, particularly in Eastern Europe. Most of them are coming from the old Soviet bloc. But there are a lot of very fascinating new production black market guns. These are machined by actual machine shops, actual factories, proper machine shop production. These are very, very interesting. But for the purpose of this podcast, I want to focus on the do-it-yourself handmade guns. The next category of which is 3D printed firearm lowers, but every other part of the gun uses factory parts, either OEM or third-party parts. And this is basically what most of the guys experimenting in the USA are doing. We will often see people who 3D print a Glock lower, but then they have a Glock slide and a Glock barrel. They have the recoil spring. They have the drop-in trigger. They have all of the parts that are very easy to get here in the United States. They're probably using off-the-shelf mags. They're definitely not having to concoct their own ammunition. And there's a huge amount of options here. And this is not as weird as you might think. There are some people in the government who are still believing that if you put 2 or 3 pounds of metal onto a little piece of plastic, it is invisible to an X-ray. Or there are people who believe that if you put a whole bunch of metal components onto a plastic frame, like a Glock frame, then you have something that is technically a bomb in your hands, even though Glocks have actually been, you know, made out of plastic for a long time. The fact is that there are a lot of different filaments that you can use if you have an FDM printer, and there's a lot of different resins that you could use if you have an SLA printer that give you strength that is not the same as an injection molded Glock lower, but it is enough, especially if you're familiar with the way that most polymer frame striker fire pistols work. There are metal rails inside of the lower that the slide rides on. So if you are able to buy those metal rails and you're able to set those into your 3D part, the plastic isn't actually doing a whole lot. It's less durable for sure. If you were to drop it or run it over with a car, it's not going to survive in the same way that a Glock is, because Glocks are, of course, invincible, because invincibility is an aspect of perfection and Glocks are perfect. But if you 3D print a Glock lower, even though it's not as durable, it's not going to survive everything, and it may not hold up to tens of thousands of rounds. There's definitely guys who have put thousands of rounds through 3D printed Glock lowers. And there are even weapon platforms that I think have been improved upon by having 3D printed lowers. So there's a project called the Low Point, which is a upgraded High Point. The High Point firearm, as you know, is a very cheap and nasty and primitive and crude direct blowback firearm with a giant heavy slide made out of pot metal and a fixed barrel. And one of the downsides of this gun, in addition to everything that I just mentioned, is that it has a single stack magazine and no light rail, so if you wanted to put a weapon light on it, you just couldn't. But for all of its downsides, oftentimes you can find High Point parts kits on GunBroker for like $50 or less. And if you 3D print a lower, you can actually 3D print a High Point lower that has a light rail. And there's even guys that have made some that take CZ75 mags. So now you have a double stack gun with a light rail that uses $50 worth of parts that you got on GunBroker. That's actually not too bad, and it's a considerable step up from the High Point. There's also some guys building high power lowers, Browning high powers, and I really want one of those. And then another personal favorite of mine is the Shield Asp project. It's kind of a reworking of Paris Theodore's 1970 concept, which was built on the Smith & Wesson Model 39, and actually kind of paved the way for a lot of the little mini concealment pistols that we have now. So it's very poetic that people are building little ASP replicas using Smith & Wesson Shield parts, and it has all the functions that the original ASP has. So there's a lot of really interesting projects here, which are, they're not necessarily pushing an envelope, and they're not nearly as dangerous to the people who are working on them as the folks that are doing this inside of Europe. These are fun. These are interesting. They're educational. Oftentimes, they add features which are useful, like the Low Point. Sometimes, they're just kind of goofy, like there are people building Glock lowers that look like Halo pistols. But there's also people building out rifle lowers. So the AR-15 lowers are normally aluminum, as you know, but there have been some polymer lowers that have been extremely successful. We have a couple of pre-What Would Stoner Do Project Cav Arms lowers, which are fantastic. And there are guys building AR-15 lowers on 3D printers. Oftentimes, they have to be reinforced with machine screws. There's one model that's very effective that's the castle nut is reinforced with a U-bolt. So with a few off-the-shelf metal parts and maybe adjusting the model so that the exterior dimensions are a little bit bigger, beefed up so that they're a little bit stronger than they would have been otherwise, you can actually get a very functional, very usable AR-15 lower off of a $200 or $300 3D printer. And while this isn't nearly as challenging or as game-changing or as risky as the stuff that our European brothers are doing in building stuff basically from scratch, basically from the ground up, basically with things that you wouldn't ever suspect would be a part of a firearm, this is still kind of a big deal. And I think that it is part of the reason that the ATF really wants to redefine exactly how they label a firearm. As you know, they requested comments on a proposed rule change where they're going to completely redefine what is and what isn't a firearm and what has to have serial numbers on it. And there's, I think, three reasons for this. One is the current definition is actually pretty bad, especially when they're talking about AR-15s. The other reason is there's a bunch of 80% lowers out there, which they don't particularly like, the ease of creating an unserialized lower. The third reason is these 3D printed lowers. It's actually very simple and easy to build the part of the gun that the ATF thinks is the gun. Because with the current system that we have in the United States, all the parts that are hard to make are very easy to get, and they don't have serial numbers on them. And all the parts that are hard to get because they have serial numbers on them are technically very easy to make. And then I want to include a fourth category here of do-it-yourself firearms. And this would be the weird, very advanced weapon experiments. There are guys on Instagram, one person in particular I'm thinking of, who is messing around with electrical ignition and 3D printing his own caseless ammo. There are also guys that are doing weapon-related experiments outside of the firearm space. Like, there's a guy that I'm thinking of who 3D prints rocket engines, but he also 3D prints using ABS filament the solid rocket fuel stacks that go inside the rocket nozzles that he's 3D printing out of a different material. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that's being experimented with here simply because of these new manufacturing techniques that may not directly be what we currently define as a firearm, like a electrically ignited plasma-based caseless black powder muzzleloader, but guys are making those. Now, again, I would like to point out that 3D printing is, at this point, a still fairly young technology. And while it has tremendous applications in rapid prototyping, it is the best possible way to experiment with stuff. It isn't necessarily going to be the best for production parts, but it is a technology that is rapidly improving. So real quick, I'll run over the three different kinds of 3D printers. FDM is fused deposition modeling. That's the filament 3D printers like the Ender 3. And a lot of the filaments that are being used are very low temperature filaments, and they don't really stick together quite as well as you would hope. They lay down layers one at a time, and those layers stick together, but not as well as a plastic part. So if you print a part out of ABS filament, it's not going to be as strong as a Lego brick, which is also made out of ABS plastic. But there's a couple things that you can do to try to get more strength out of things. There are better filaments. You can get better print heads for your cheap 3D printers so that you can print at higher temperatures and get better adhesion between the layers. Or you can anneal the plastic, which is basically take your plastic part that you have printed, and then you can either pack it in something like plaster of Paris, or a very interesting experiment that a guy on YouTube came up with is you pack your part inside of powdered salt, and then you throw that in the oven. You melt that ABS plastic or that PLA plastic down so that it is completely molten, but it stays the same shape because it's held in place by that powdered salt that you have really packed in all around it. And then you have a single fused monolithic part that has tremendous strength to it. So there's a lot of ways that even with these cheap tools, you can get really phenomenally strong and improved results. Then there's SLA printing, which is stereolithography, and that used to be really expensive because the way that it worked was a UV laser would harden a resin in a very specific place. Again, layer by layer by layer, building up this resin, hardening it into exactly the right shape. But then somebody realized it doesn't have to be a laser. If we put a LCD screen down here and we put a UV backlight under it, we can do the same thing. And SLA printers are now cheaper than dirt. I mean, they're cheaper than an entire truckload of dirt, like $200 worth of dirt. Far, far more accessible. And people are tinkering with different types of resins that give different types of material properties. So that's improving. And then the next step up is SLS, which is selective laser sintering. And this is where you have a bed of powder. And this powder can either be like a nylon powder, something that is quite strong. And then a laser actually melts that powder together and fuses it together. And that gives you something that is very strong. So if you see a 3D print that has horizontal lines running through it, that's probably filament. If you see a 3D print that looks kind of grainy, that's probably this laser sintering. And if the laser is powerful enough, if it's hot enough, you can actually use like an aluminum powder. You can actually make a metal part. Of these three technologies that are the most accessible, they're improving rapidly. And I would expect that we'll see continuous improvement. We'll see greater capabilities. They'll be able to make more and more of the parts of a firearm. And that's going to be really interesting. It's going to be good for the people who are making the Category 3 firearms, where they're 3D printing just the lower and buying stuff off the shelf. They'll be able to 3D print maybe more of the parts, or at the very least, better and more durable parts. But it's also going to be great for the people making the Category 2, nothing can come off of the shelf, nothing can come from a firearm category, because they will be able to make more of those parts, better parts, more durable parts. And that will be a great improvement for them. And I see all of these developments as being really positive things. And it's not just for guns. I think something that is really important for us to remember is guns are merely tools in the same way that 3D printers are. But tools that can make tools are incredibly important. There's all kinds of tools that are useful and helpful and productive to have. And guns are in that category. Guns are not a separate category of their very own. But learning about this technology is something that I feel like all of us should do. All of us should be more capable when it comes to using tools. Whether those tools be firearms or whether those tools be manufacturing technology, all of us should be more adept and more capable at making things, at producing things, at using tools. I think that now is the time to really focus on this. Even though CNC machining technology is getting cheaper now, it's not necessarily getting easier. The software is easier to use, but making an AR-15 lower out of aluminum involves a lot of jigs and clamps and hold downs and running multiple operations and really understanding some of the science of machining. And that's not quite as easy to learn as loading the 3D file into your 3D printer and hitting print. This is very accessible technology. It's not only affordable, but it's very easy to learn and to experiment with. And there's a lot of people who are doing really interesting and useful experiments, which are going to teach you valuable things about production of either a firearm or some other kind of tool. So I would really recommend that those of you who have any interest whatsoever at all immediately begin looking into this. I would start with the controlpew.com beginner's guide. Whether you're printing guns or printing anything, ControlPew probably has the best beginner's guide to 3D printing that I've come across on the internet. And there's a bunch of guys doing fascinating stuff. They're developing 3D models that make very functional firearms. You should look into print, shoot, repeat, deterrence dispensed, although I think they're moving to the Gatalog. You should look up Mr. Snow, and definitely Ivan the Troll. But I really want to mention specifically the work that Jay Stark has done. It really cannot be overstated the importance of what he has accomplished, both from a design perspective, but also from an inspirational perspective. I would also look up a documentary that was made by Popular Front about 3D printed firearms, and it features Jay Stark. He does his interview as anonymously as possible. It seems, my German is not very good, but reading the article in Der Spiegel about what happened to him, apparently they were able to track him down based on things that he purchased from the UK. So some British financial services guys managed to figure out that this particular person was ordering things that could potentially be used in a firearm, and that was the way that he got. And then after his house was raided and they found nothing, he passed away in a vehicle from some sort of heart condition, which is potentially plausible. He did apparently have health conditions, but still seems a little bit suspicious. Not as suspicious as a 3D printed Luti submachine gun, but suspect nonetheless. And I also want us to remember that as fun and interesting and safe as it is for those of us in the United States to build our own firearms and to tinker and to experiment, there are guys who are doing the same experiments and doing the same tinkering with a much greater set of obstacles, and the cost of failure is much, much higher. I'd point at Philip Luti as an example of this. He's somebody who is in the UK. He's a very kindly old man who never did anything wrong except a little bit of stuff in his shed that he wasn't supposed to. And the anti-terror groups actually wanted to drag him back in after he had done his time so that they could throw the book at him again just because there had been a new anti-terror act and they were able to retroactively go after him for the same crime that he'd already been punished for. So this is the kind of risk that people in the EU are currently facing. This is the kind of risk that they face to do these sorts of experiments and to build these kinds of tools and to have the kind of capabilities that every man and woman should have. The ability to defend themselves using tools, the ability to learn how to use tools, manufacturing tools or defense tools. And one of the things that I would like to do with the podcast, since it is a bit of a freer platform, is to spend some more time on this particular issue, on the issue of the capability, having local manufacturing capability to make tools, and of those tools to also make defensive and offensive weapons. That is a very important thing for people to have. It is an incredibly important tool for the preservation of liberty and of freedom. And when you see what happens to people who are trying to preserve liberty and freedom in places like Germany and the UK and Australia, it only underscores how important it actually is that that freedom and that liberty be maintained. In Germany and in the UK, this idea that you should be able to manufacture your own firearms is so incredibly foreign that the idea that you would even try to do so is essentially proof positive that you were going to do something horrific. The other terrible thing about this Der Spiegel article about Jay Stark is that They assume that he's going to be exactly the same type of person with exactly the same goals as the 2019 Hollis shooter. There is no proof of this, and yet the article basically says it's a good thing that he got caught, and the $200 3D printers that he was using and the very basic machine and hand tools that can be used to manufacture a defensive tool like a firearm are so terrifyingly dangerous that they actually need to be removed from the general public. Machine shops are basically gone from UK public schools, which they call private schools, and there's an awful lot of conversation about restricting access to really simple manufacturing tools, really simple manufacturing techniques, information that is as basic as drawings of 1911s from over 100 years ago. The ability to manufacture weapons, the ability to manufacture tools, the ability to take personal responsibility for our own lives and the lives of the people around us are vital. And people who are trying to do that against all odds, through tremendous obstacles and at great risk, we should bear that in mind and pay attention to the work that they have attempted to do. And in the case of Jay Stark, the work that they have very successfully done.